How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Figure Four Daily. It's December 1st, 2011 here at figure4online.com/wrestlingobserver.com. We are joined, as we are every week, by Todd Doc Martin here on the line. We got, I normally say we have plenty of stuff to talk about today, but that would be a lie. Almost nothing is going on, but we're going to try and fill a full show with nothing. Todd, how you doing today?
That was a great selling point you just made there, Brian.
I know, and it's a free show. It's even better. The freeloaders are listening to this right now going, man, I can't believe I'm getting this for free.
Well, you set it up so great. Now we've got to deliver.
Yes. Well, let's start with something that's actually apropos, since it took place last night. I probably used the wrong word, but I don't care. It's early in the morning. Ultimate Fighter. Last night, it was the finals prior to the finale. We now have the finals. Another great sentence there by me early in the show today. Let's look at what we've got for Saturday. Michael Bisping, Jason Miller is the main event. They are, of course, the two coaches on the show this season. For those of you that did not watch this season of Ultimate Fighter, you missed out, homies. Great season, great fights, great characters. No characters like, crazy Chris Lieben on the first season, which we can actually talk about here after a while. But everybody, I talked about this on the Dave show last night. If you only watch last night's show, if that's the only show you watched all season, you know that John Dodson is like a crazy guy who thinks he's the best and a pretty damn good fighter. You know that Dennis Bermudez is perhaps going to get slaughtered by Diego because there was a moment at the end of the show where Diego cut a promo on him and Dennis kind of curled up into a little ball and looked horrified. Diego Brandão is a Brazilian who is a crazy man, and he's a crazy fighter, and he loves his mom. And he wants to win all this money, go back to Brazil, buy her a house for Christmas, and use his money to get his brother away from the druggers, as he said. And, of course, Michael Bisping is the evil Englishman. Jason Mayhem Miller is the babyface American. I just thought last night's show was, it wasn't even like the best show, probably not even the best show of the last few weeks, but I thought last night's show was great.
Yeah, I think that this season's been a great season. I mean, it's been very entertaining. Going in, I was skeptical as to the Miller-Bisping dynamic. I thought that Miller would sort of come across as a goof and that they'd be better off putting in someone like Stan that would bring more seriousness into it, but I was completely wrong. I mean, Miller has been tremendous on the show. It's been the perfect mix of levity mixed in with a real issue between him and Bisping, and it just made for great television. I mean, I think a lot of it is that, you know, you have all these great fights. So, I mean, I think that would have been a great season regardless of who the coaches were. But the coaches have definitely added a lot to it. So, I mean, kudos to UFC. They made a great choice in terms of the coaches. And if you recall, this was a season where, I mean, they really struggled to come up with the coaches and that they wanted Chael originally opposite Bisping. But, you know, there was that big California hearing and he didn't get approved and he couldn't get the second license. So they had to put in someone else. And they were sort of searching around for a bunch of different possibilities. But, I mean, in the end, they really hit a home run. And, yeah, I mean, last night's show was another great show, and what's been a line of them. I mean, on top of all the things you messed up, there were some brutal late stoppages in both of the fights. I mean, mm-hmm. Both of those fights, people were just getting absolutely destroyed. And referees in both the fights, there's different referees in each fight, but they took a long time. And there were some, you know, those were some brutal fights as well.
Well, actually, I mean, in the John versus Johnny fight, I don't even know if I can say the ref was late getting in, just that John delivered so many hammer fists in such a short period of time that Herb Dean was late on the ball. But even Dana talked about it being kind of a late stoppage. He didn't even blame Herb Dean because it was like it happened so fast that I mention this all the time. When you're refereeing, you know, you don't get a chance to go back and watch it in slow motion and then watch a replay. And then, you know, when you watch a replay, A, you know it was coming. And so since you know when it's coming in your mind, you're like already starting your stopwatch. But like real life situations, I mean, to me, I can probably count on one hand the number of calls that in real life I thought, my God, where the hell was this referee? Because you know it immediately before you even see the first replay. You're like, oh my God, that took forever to get in there. But in both these situations, it was like, yeah, maybe when you watch the replay, you're like, he could have been there faster. But at the moment, it just happened so fast. I mean, those hammer fists were just bam, 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 bam. And he got in there as quick as he could, but still, that poor guy took a beating.
Yeah, I think you could definitely say that on the Dodson fight. And I wasn't even bringing it up to sort of criticize the referees. I just thought it was sort of an interesting spectacle. The other fight, though, wasn't like that. The other fight was just that Brian Caraway was just getting destroyed. And the referee, I think the referee at the beginning decided he was going to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. And, like, the worst point was, like, at the beginning. And then he just kept getting beaten, but it wasn't really getting worse. It was just sort of, if anything, he was getting a little bit more into it, but he was still getting clobbered and he was still out of it. So the beating lasted for quite a while with Caraway just, you know, really, really taking a beating before the fight was stopped. And I thought that one was more late than the other one, quite frankly, as far as, you know, how long it went on. But, I mean, I'm not even necessarily faulting the referees. I was just sort of striking. And for all the talk about Caraway sort of being a head case, which, I mean, sort of seemed almost a take-home point during this season of the Ultimate Fighter, because so many people were pointing out at different points. I mean, he showed a fighter's heart and mettle in
sure.
that fight.
Yeah, God bless Brian Caraway, you know. But there were people going in that predicted he was going to win the whole season. And, I mean, literally from, like, the first 1 minute that I saw him on this show, it was like, this guy may be a good fighter. He may win some fights. But there's no way this guy is winning. I just thought, to be a big success in UFC, and I'm sure everybody can find an example here and there where someone like this makes it to the top level, but you know, when you look at guys that are just training, and then you look at guys that are fighting on local shows, and then you look at guys that maybe are fighting on Strikeforce Challengers, then you look at guys that are maybe in Bellator, and all the way up to fighting in the main event of a UFC pay-per-view. You know, these guys are elite fighters in every way, you know, and a big part of that is your mental discipline and your attitude. And, yeah, you're going to have some guys that, I mean, Chris Liebman's a prime example. I mean, yes, the guy is a head case, but you know what? He's a head case in a lot of different ways, but when it comes to fighting, he's not a head case. He's going to go in there, he's going to train his ass off, although we could talk about what happened recently and we can debate that, but for the most part, he's going to train his ass off and he's going to believe that he can go in there and beat everybody, and he's determined, and that's what you get in these top-level fighters. And Brian Caraway, to me, came off as a guy that you're very, very talented. You know, you're a great grappler, you're very good at all of the technical aspects of this sport, but to get from the level you're at now to fighting in the UFC and on a UFC pay-per-view, you cannot go in there with the attitude that you've got. The defeatist attitude and, you know, just, I mean, watching the show was like, there's just no way. There's no way this guy goes to the end because he's going to crack under the pressure. I mean, I that's one I should have made a bet on because I was just firmly convinced watching this guy that it was just not going to happen. And, you know, maybe he'll have a good showing on the Ultimate Fighter finale, but I just think it's going to be a bigger stage. He's going to feel like he's fighting for his job. He's in a dark match, and I think he's just going to probably choke again.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I try to avoid playing psychologist too much with fighters.
I
brought it up because so many different people on the show were saying that with him. I do agree with you, though, that I didn't really have that high of hopes for Caraway on the show. I mean, my rationale is more relates to the sort of fighter that he is typically doesn't do as well in Ultimate Fighter in the sense that he's more of a finished product at this point. He's a guy that's fought for quite a while. He's been fighting for 6 or 7 years. You know, he's fought in quality camps. He's fought on big shows. I mean, he's not a guy that's evolving a lot as a fighter. And typically, we've seen a lot of that sort of guy on the Ultimate Fighter, and they're typically go in there with high expectations but don't perform as well. And the guys that tend to do better in Ultimate Fighter are guys that are on the come up, guys that are still evolving, that are still improving, that are, you know, sort of at a younger point in their career and are on their way to bigger things. I mean, I think that, you know, TJ Dillashaw being sort of an operative example of that. I think those guys just over the years have tended to do well as the seasons have progressed and after the seasons. Whereas I look at Caraway as sort of more like a Mac Danzig, a guy who's a good fighter, but you essentially know what he is at this point. And I think Danzig's probably a better overall fighter than Caraway, but I think they're sort of similar in that I don't see Caraway, you know, improving a lot in the next 5 years, whereas I could see Brandao potentially, you know, improving a lot over the next 5 years. And Dillashaw is certainly very early on where he's just going to keep getting better. I mean, another example that comes to mind with that is Brendan Schaub or Matt Mitrione from recent seasons, or even another guy that's fighting on the show, Tony Ferguson, all guys that were really hadn't made their mark yet, hadn't really fought on big shows yet before getting the opportunity.
You know, the Diego situation, Diego looked great on this season.
Absolutely. I mean, you could argue that this guy looked more impressive on this season than anyone has ever looked on The Ultimate Fighter. Regardless of where you think he's going, I mean, he's just been obliterating guys on this show.
He looked awesome. And, you know, there are people that think he's going to go right into the mix in UFC. Bisping said he's going to go in there and he's going to kill his opponent, he said. Kill him! And then go on, win the thing, and become a big star. That was his prediction there. And, of course, he made that prediction on MMA, or on Inside MMA on Monday, which arguably spoiled this particular match. But, you know, I was watching it, and I was blown away by this guy. You know, both his fighting and just how awesome he was on the show with his promos and how he's going to spend his money. And then you look at his record, and granted, a guy like Randy Couture, for example, you look at his record and you're like, man, guy couldn't have been that good, but he was that good. You know, his record just maybe didn't reflect it, which actually is the argument that I made for Uriah Faber last week, which was quite controversial, apparently. But Diego does not have the best record. And, you know, he's lost fights. He's lost fights via decision. He's been knocked out. He's lost via TKO. He's had his losses here and there. So, you know, he's on a win streak now. If you count Ultimate Fighter, I guess it'd be like a 5-6 fight win streak. So maybe whatever it was clicked in his head. Or maybe he's one of those guys that, my God, he looks impressive. And then you put him in the ring with somebody who you expect him to obliterate, and he just gets knocked out. I've been watching fighting for so long that I cannot go immediately into the Michael Bisping camp and just say he's going to destroy everybody and be a player. We'll have to see. He certainly looks it.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you on as far as what we need to see from him going forward. And you've got, a number of key points. One is that, I mean, and I'm sure there's no way you're not right, well aware of this, but I mean, he's not fighting the guys that Randy Couture and Uriah Faber are fighting. I mean, those guys,
of course,
you know, yeah, they have losses, but they're losses to real, legit guys on big shows. Whereas Brandao, you know, he's been losing to guys that nobody knows. I mean, there are a couple UFC veterans mixed in there, but it's typically been guys that aren't particularly good. So, I mean, that gives you pause, along with the fact that, as we talked about, he's looked so impressive, but that's with these big, spectacular first-round knockouts. And there are a lot of guys in MMA where, you know, they come out like a house of fire and, you know, they're looking to, you know, knock you out early. And if you fight through and you're able to avoid the early fire, you're able to do better late. And I was looking through Brandao's record for that trend, and that's exactly what it is. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I have them written down somewhere. And, like, his record in the first round is tremendous. His record in the second and third round is very weak, which says to me he's a guy that, you know, comes out like a house of fire and tends to fade. So, I mean, and that potentially plays into Bermudez's hands, his opponent on Saturday night, because Bermudez is a guy that over the course of the show has been in trouble a lot of times early in fights and has found ways to fight through it and to pull out a win through adversity. So Bermudez is a guy that potentially would be well-equipped to deal with that issue going forward. So I think that, you know, it's an interesting fight on Saturday night. I favor Brandao just because of how impressive he's looked, but I think Bermudez is very much a live underdog as someone that's being favored, as someone that's a fairly significant underdog.
All right, so now the other two fights, Dodson Dillashaw and Bisping Miller, what are your predictions?
Well, I mean, Bisping Miller is an interesting fight in the sense that I think they're both guys that tend to be overlooked, and I think they're both kind of overlooking the other. And that, you know, I've heard them both speak about the other opponent, and they both kind of dismiss them. You know, Bisping, you know, points out that Miller's a guy that has come up short in a lot of fights when he's been in his biggest fights, and Miller points out that Bisping hasn't beaten a lot of people. I think both of them are kind of thinking that the other guy is overrated, which, I mean, is sort of an interesting dynamic. I think that I do favor Bisping on the feet, but, I mean, Miller is not a bad striker. He's not a guy that has a particularly bad chin, and Bisping isn't renowned as a big knockout striker. And you got to figure that Miller probably has the edge on the ground if it gets to the ground. So I think it's going to be a competitive fight, but I think it's going to be prototypical of a lot of Bisping fights where he's going to get by with better striking, and over time, he's going to sort of, his conditioning is also going to play a role because he keeps up a good pace and he tends to do better as fights go on. And this is a 5-round fight. So I favor Bisping, but it's a very interesting fight. And I mean, it's probably the biggest grudge match they've had on television in a number of years. So hopefully it'll draw a good rating. I know they haven't been promoting it very much, but I think the potential is there for it to be a strong rating fight.
All right, before we talk about some pro wrestling here...
We didn't talk about the other fights.
No one cares. No. All right, fine, if you want to do predictions for the other spike...
You say that so begrudgingly. I like to talk about fights.
I know you do, Todd, but this is a show for the masses.
I think people like to talk about fights, too.
Eve Edwards and Tony Ferguson.
We also didn't do the Ultimate Fighter finale, but sure, I'll talk about that, too.
Ultimate Fighter finale? Wait a second, what are you talking about?
No, we didn't. We didn't talk about the other final, the Dillashaw-Dodson fight. But to talk about Edwards and Ferguson first, I mean, Ferguson is a guy that I feel has really been underrated by a lot of people. I think he's looked consistently pretty good throughout his UFC career, and he's a guy that is sort of improving every fight. I mean, I was expecting, you know, a competitive fight against Aaron Riley last time, and he really went through Aaron Riley. And Eve Edwards is better than I think any other opponent he's had to date, but he's not a guy that it's the top level yet. So it'll be interesting to see how he does with a very crafty, tough striker and a guy that has a good ground game too. I favor Ferguson, but I think it's an interesting fight as well.
Then we've got Johnny. Dave wrote Fedford, which I think is actually a better name, against Lewis.
Johnny Bedford Stuyvesant.
Gaudinot? It's early. Thoughts on that fight?
I don't think Bedford is that good. I haven't been particularly impressed with him throughout the show. And on the other hand, I think I have been overall pretty impressed with the performances on the show by Luis. So I favor Luis. But yeah, I mean, that's not a fight that I have a lot to, you know, sort of a lot of analysis on, because I mean, we only saw each of them a few times on the show. So it's sort of a relatively limited sample size.
All right. Now let's talk about Lieben.
We still didn't talk about the Dillashaw-Dodson fight.
My God, I feel like I brought that fight about 6 times. What are your thoughts on TJ Dillashaw and John Dodson in the bantamweight tournament finals?
Well, I mean, Dodson's more of a complete fighter. I mean, he's the guy that...
Wasn't he WWE fighting security for a while, or is it somebody else?
I think that's somebody else. Okay. I don't see Dodson, after he's done with MMA, being a guy that Vince would be interested in hiring. I mean, he's more of a complete package at this point, and Dillashaw is a guy that's still evolving. So, I mean, I think if these guys fought in 3 years, I think Dillashaw would be a huge favorite. At this point, I think he's still a favorite, but it's more of a live fight, because I mean, Dodson is a very good striker, and I think he's gonna present some problems for Dillashaw there in the striking department. Dillashaw has a great wrestling background, and we'll see how Dodson does off his back if Dillashaw consistently puts him there. So I think it's another interesting Ultimate Fighter finale. I think both of the finals fights are very interesting fights.
So this guy, Chris Lieben.
Yes.
He had a problem with painkillers.
Mm-hmm.
Anything new to add to this debate we've been having in the last few days? Not really even a debate, but what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I haven't listened to your show with Josh yet, so if there's some sort of debate, I don't know exactly
Actually,
what it is.
Actually, there's no debate. We just agreed he had a problem, and that this is probably a problem with a lot of fighters who are smart enough to get off with 3 days before their test.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably is the case. I think that it does... I think it depends upon how hard people are fighting. And Lieben's always a guy that's really left it all in the cage and has really been in a lot of wars, which I think, you know, is going to lead to more in the way of concussions. It's going to lead to more in the way of pain, and is going to potentially lead to depression. I mean, we've seen in the NHL there was a rash of suicides in the off season, and it wasn't a bunch of skill players. It was the goons, for lack of a better term, the guys that go out there and fight. So I mean, if you're out there, you know, like George St. Pierre, I think you can get by without dealing with a lot of pain. I think you have there's stress on your body from sort of consistent performance, and you've got to keep your body at a certain level. But it's not like I don't think you're working through as much pain as a guy like Lieben is. So, I mean, it was certainly not a surprise to see Lieben having those issues. And it's sad to see, because, I mean, he's a guy that, I mean, he's had his personal demons, and he's made mistakes over the years. But I really view Lieben as a guy that wants to do well and has really tried to improve his life and try to become a better person over time. And I think a lot of people can relate to Lieben as, you know, a guy that, you know, you know people like that are sort of fuck ups when they're younger, but, you know, really are doing their best to try to, you know, put everything together. And, you know, it's difficult in that sort of situation, to move forward when you've got issues with serious issues with pain and with sort of the strains of a hard life. So, yeah.
You a big sports fan?
I'm a very big sports fan.
All right. Then you'd be a perfect person to answer this question. It seems to me that some people are under the impression that we're just now learning about the dangers of concussions. And I've always found people who believe that to be kind of naive, in the sense that, yes, there's a lot more research nowadays into concussions and the effect of concussions and tau proteins and everything else. There's a lot more research today than there was a decade ago. But anybody who thinks that, like, a decade ago, people didn't know it was bad news to get whacked in the head, yes, there were wrestlers that were really stupid, and they would get concussions, and they would fight through it, because that was kind of the mentality. But I think I think a lot of them even knew that was not the smartest idea. I mean, my first like pro wrestling match in a ring was in 1998. And I remember people would, cause this was obviously the mid 90s, you know, they'd be like, you want to take a chair shot? And I was like, there ain't no way you're hitting me in the head with a chair. No way. You know, it was no mystery that getting hit in the head with stuff was no good back then. We didn't know exactly all of the details, but I think everybody knew that it was bad news. So my question for you is, you mentioned the hockey players that killed themselves in the off season, and, you know, ever since Benoit, there's news reports all the time of such and such an NFL player killed themselves, such and such a hockey player killed themselves. And my question is basically, are we hearing about this now because the link between brain damage and suicides is in the press, and if these things actually have been happening for years and decades, or has either by coincidence or I don't know what, there have been a rash of suicides right around the time that it has been determined that if you have serious brain damage, there's a tendency for you to want to kill yourself?
I'm having trouble thinking back to a lot of suicides in the past. And I mean, I guess...
Because the reason I ask... Let me just say one more thing here. The reason I ask is because, you know, I don't follow sports very closely. But, you know, it seems like every few months now, I hear that a sports star who got hit in the head a lot killed themselves, and their brain has been donated to wherever, and it has been discovered that they had CTE. And it's to me, it's like, you know, why didn't I hear about this stuff before? Was it just not publicized because nobody had put two and two together? Or for some strange reason, is it suddenly that now that we've learned that that head damage can cause people to commit suicide, now all of a sudden everyone's committing suicide? I'm trying to figure out what's happening here, because I did never really hear about it before Benoit, really, and all of this research has been done. But now I seem to hear about it all the time.
Well, I mean, I think with the NHL thing, it might have been that they sort of were playing a role in the other ones. As far as concussions go, I understand what you're saying about people always knowing that they're bad for you, but there really has been a revolution as far as knowing exactly how they work and just how bad they are for you.
Oh, absolutely.
Even in the last 10 years, because I mean, it was about 10 years ago that two of the most prominent quarterbacks in the NFL, Steve Young and Troy Aikman, retired after taking concussion after concussion after concussion. And those guys at that point were sort of on the cutting edge of guys deciding, hey, you know, too much head trauma, I need to get out of this. But at that point, the number of concussions that they dealt with, if they had come along now, they wouldn't have been able to, they would have packed it in a long time before they did. I mean, Sidney Crosby, one of the NHL's top stars, suffered a severe concussion. He was out for a very extended period of time and only just recently returned to the ice. And the decision was made, hey, you know, we really want to make sure that all of the, you know, post-concussion syndromes are gone and we really can clear the brain before he gets back in there. Whereas, you know, particularly in the NFL, it was sort of, oh, you know, if you get a concussion, you hopefully you're feeling better by Wednesday or Thursday, and then you play the next game. And now there's talk about, you know, potentially keeping people out for, you know, a week automatically if you suffer a concussion in a game. So, I mean,
I think it should be longer, personally, but that's another story entirely.
I mean, and very well that might be where it goes. I mean, that's sort of a starting off point, and it might get more, you know, might get more over time. But there's definitely, I don't think we should underplay the increase in information as far as how much is known about concussions, because there really has been a revolution in the last 5 years as far as people doing really excellent, hard research on the subject and then putting it out through the media so that people understand how concussions work. And I think it's something that was always out there that, you know, that obviously, just like you said, you know, you don't want to get hit with a chair repeatedly. That's bad for you. But what exactly does it mean? What does it mean if you suffer a number of little hits to the head over a period of time as opposed to one big one? What does it mean as far as recovery time for how long you want to have a concussion? There's a lot of issues there. And
those
there's
are
still
actually
a lot of information that we don't know.
Those are actually the biggest changes right there is the understanding of many small post-concussive blows being bad news. Because, you know, the very idea of it being bad to be hit in the head, I mean, they had studies in the early part of the 20th century on boxers that showed, oh, these, you know, a relatively high percentage of boxers end up with dementia. Well, how about that? So, you know, it was not a mystery that being hit in the head was bad news, but the specifics of it, you know, does this affect soccer players who head the ball? You know, these types of questions are the ones that are really coming to the forefront today. But the general idea of hit in head equals bad, you know, it's been around forever.
Yeah. I mean, when we had Dave Epstein on, I mean, that was one of the points that he talked about, was sort of the issues with sort of repeated head trauma over a period of time with, you know, sort of little things like you brought up, like getting headers in soccer or, you know, in various sports. I remember reading an article about how people are suffering a lot of concussions with cheerleading when they get dropped on their head. So, I mean, there's a lot of, you know,
cheerleading is dangerous, dude.
Yeah, I mean, people, you know, it's sort of something that people don't think of as being dangerous, but certainly, you know, the article I was reading pointed out a lot of dangers to it.
All right, Raw this past Monday night, again, a show that was better than that string of about six horrendous shows, but when it was over, Same with SmackDown. We'll talk Raw and SmackDown. SmackDown was also live on Tuesday night. And two shows that, as self-contained shows, were fine. They were enjoyable. They had some good wrestling on them. But when they were over, I have absolutely no idea what's going on at TLC. And it's coming up like... In fact, the best part of SmackDown was that Michael Cole couldn't remember how many weeks till the next pay-per-view. That was awesome. I think 3 weeks, he said. Thanks, Mike.
Sounds about right. As far as Raw goes, one of my big take-home points was I really liked the bringing up of Cena and his reactions to getting booed. I wrote about this a little bit in the report I did, but I think it's something that I haven't heard a lot of people talking about. I think it's a really positive development in that I think one of the least likable things about Cena's character is the way that he reacts to getting booed, where, like, people are just, you know, and it's not like they're saying, you know, boo, we want you to lose. It's like, you know, we hate you. We don't want to watch you. We think you suck and are untalented at what you've chosen as your profession. And, I mean, that's not a minor thing. I mean, it's very strong criticism that comes forward towards Cena. And so when Cena just sort of laughs it off and smiles about it, I mean, I think it really reflects negatively on his character on sort of two levels. On one level is that it plays into the inauthenticity of his character, where people perceive him as just being sort of this corporate puppet that does whatever WWE wants. So WWE wants him to smile and grin and bear it, when behind the scenes he's probably pissed off about it, I think, or the way people are thinking about it. So it makes him seem more inauthentic, which is one of the principal problems of this character. And moreover, it just makes him seem like a bitch. I mean, here's a guy that, you know, everyone are just shitting all over, and he's like, ho, ho, ho. You know, like, stand up for yourself. Have some backbone. You know, like, if people are, you know, are giving you a hard time, give them a hard time back, too. It shows that you have some, you know, you have some balls. You have some integrity. So, I mean, I think that the fact that Cena doesn't do that, I think, has always been a gigantic negative for his character, at least to me. So the bringing up of it, I think, is very positive, both in the short term and the long term. Because in the short term, if you're not gonna fight back at the fans, at least you can acknowledge this issue and explain it. And I thought Cena was a lot more likable on Monday's show when he tried to explain, look, you know, like, I've got all these kids who like me. I'm doing charity. You know, I'm trying to, you know, I'm living my dream here. So, I can blow that off. You know, I understand what you're saying, but I'm in an okay place. Like, that to me seemed like a real reaction to that could potentially be his reaction behind the scenes. And I don't know whether he feels that way or he didn't, but I could buy that a lot more than him just sort of grinning in, you know, sort of in an ebullient manner, acting like it's nothing. I don't buy that reaction. So I think that's a positive in the short term of making him more likable. And in the long term, it also plants the seeds for a heel turn. He can act now like, oh, you know, they're bringing it up as an issue. And he can say, oh, it isn't an issue. But then down the line, he can say, you know, look, it was an issue the whole time. You know, like, I've been, you know, you've been bringing this up, the fact that I've been getting these negative reactions, the fact that I, you know, am acting like I don't like it. But of course I don't like it. I think you people are dickheads, and, you know, I had to act like I didn't like it, but I'm sick of pretending, and, you know, you people suck. I don't like you. I don't want to have anything to do with you. Or at least the adult segment, if you want to do sort of the half-half turn, or you could do the full turn. So I think in the short term and the long term, it's a very positive development. I was very pleased with them doing that, even if they brought it up in sort of a, you know, sort of a convoluted manner with the way they did it with Piper.
You know, Todd, one of my favorite guests on the show, but I think the reason that nobody's talking about that thing is because nobody has any faith in WWE right now. You know, it's like, I think everybody thinks it was something they did on Monday because Piper was there, and maybe they'll bring it up again in the future. Maybe they'll bring it up several times, but then in the end, it's just going to be completely dropped, and he'll just remain Super Cena, as they call him, forever.
I mean, it's possible, but again, like,
I'm impressed
one,
that you still have faith, is what I'm saying.
I'm not even sure that I have that much faith. Like, I don't think that Cena in his current role is sustainable. There's just too much of a backlash, and I think that they have to recognize.
Yeah, it's been like that for years.
I'm sorry?
It's been like that for years.
Yeah, but it's getting worse. It's getting worse.
All right.
And I think they have to recognize at some point that it really limits their ability to bring in new fans, because there's a large segment of the people that could be watching that don't want to watch a show built around this character as the top babyface. Putting aside that, okay, even if we assume that they are going to keep Cena a babyface in perpetuity, that goes to a point that I brought up, which is that this makes him more likable in the short term. I think it has the potential to cool the backlash to some degree when you've got a more real Cena character acknowledging this dilemma of the way that people are reacting to him and giving sort of what feels like an authentic reaction to that, which is, you know, what I outlined earlier. I think that I watching that, found Cena more likable than he usually is. And if they continue with that direction where they have Cena from time to time, not just simply, you know, pretend like, oh, you know, I'm really happy about this, but you sort of explain, I've got things in my life that things are going good for me, I can put that aside. I think that adds, you know, it makes him more human, it makes him more relatable in his reactions to the negativity. So I think even if you're going to keep him in the role that he is for now, that's still a big positive in making him more likable as a face.
Honest question here. Do you really think it's getting worse?
Yeah. Since Rock came back, it's been getting worse.
Well, it's worse when Rock's around, but I think in general, I mean, I don't think his getting booed is any worse than it's been in the last 3 years.
No, I think since The Rock came back, like throughout town, because I've sort of, I mean, and obviously you'd have to go through show by show and sort of look through it. But I mean, my perception of it is that it was really bad a few years ago, and then it sort of cooled off for a while, and then it sort of started to get worse before The Rock came back, and then when Rock came back, it really got pretty bad. Because I remember a point where you could sort of recognize like certain cities were going to boo Cena, but the other cities would cheer Cena. And this week, I mean, they thought that even in South Carolina, which is a place where Cena would typically get a more positive reaction as opposed to the Northeast, even they were expecting that he was going to get even more of a negative reaction than he did. So it was almost surprising when he got sort of a 50-50 reaction. I mean, they were expecting it was going to be worse, and I would have expected it to be worse. I mean, I expect every week that Cena comes out that he's going to get more boos and cheers. And he doesn't every single time, but I expect it every single time. And I don't recall that being the case at any point in the last 3 years. It was usually you could pick a market and it would depend upon the market. Now Cena, I mean, it's become very hard for adult guys to cheer Cena. I mean, I think, you know, I think if you did polls of it, you know, the people outside the crowd, I mean, I think, you know, Cena's, you know, approval rating, so to speak, among adult males would be, you know, that go to the TV tapings would be like 8% or something. I mean, I think they all hate him. It's just the children and sort of the adults that take them will sort of humor them, and then the women.
I wonder what the kids see in Cena.
He always wins.
Well, I guess there is that. So does Randy Orton. Well, not lately. I don't know. Maybe it was the jorts. I don't know what it is.
The colorful shirts, too.
Maybe they just don't recognize how clumsy he is in the ring. That's my big
thing. I mean, we've had this conversation before. I've never thought that Cena's in-ring was the biggest issue in terms of the backlash to him. I really did. I mean, very early on, there was a segment of the fan base that did, but I don't think that's ever been the prime issue. I always think it's been the character more so than the work.
See, this is why I disagree. I mentioned this on the board the other day. People are like, oh, well, Hulk Hogan was not a great in-ring technician and an Ultimate Warrior. And it's like, listen, we're talking the 80s, you know, which granted, there were some, you know, there were some great workers in the 80s. There was Randy Savage and, you know, even, I don't know. I just think that, like, you had Hulk Hogan on top forever. And then you had Warrior, and you went into the mid-90s. And then all of a sudden, you had the string of, you had Bret Hart. Actually, you had Ric Flair, and then Bret Hart, and then Shawn Michaels, and The Rock, and Steve Austin, and Triple H. And all of these guys were either great workers, great athletes, or great workers and great athletes. And even going into the early part of the 2000s, the guys that everybody loved to watch in the ring, you had the Kurt Angles and Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio, and all these guys. And then all of a sudden, bam, John Cena is the face of your company. He's not very good. He can be carried to decent matches. He's clumsy. It was like such a gigantic switch from a decade of great workers. Think of the roster. I mean, first off, just think of the champions they had in the late 90s. Granted, the roster in the late 90s, you had the garbage men and the pig farmers and such like that. But, you know, you had great workers on top. And then in the early part of the 2000s, there was like the best roster of any company of all time in WWE. All of these great workers up and down the card. And all of a sudden, 2005, 2006, John Cena. John Cena is all of a sudden the man. That was just too much for these male fans to have such a massive, rapid switch from all of those great workers to John Cena.
I don't agree on the level of Cena being that bad, and I don't agree on the level of that being a big concern for that many people. I think there are some people that are really concerned about that sort of thing, but I think if you tell good stories and you have likable characters, people aren't going to be bothered that much if you're not the best wrestler in the world. I think Cena, based on his natural charisma and his natural speaking ability, if you presented him in a better manner, I don't think that the in-ring would be an issue. I really don't.
I think that John Cena, as an average at best worker, beating all of the good workers and having a white rapper gimmick, putting all that together, I just think he's never been forgiven.
Yeah, I think the white rapper gimmick didn't help. Although, I mean, I kind of liked him better then. I mean, that really didn't bother me that much. I mean, it sort of spoke to the inauthenticity thing again, but I thought that, you know, I like the edge on that character.
He was way more authentic as a white rapper because it was real.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the beginning of that.
I said he was way more authentic as a white rapper.
Absolutely. I thought he definitely came across more authentic as that character than the character he is now.
And it was funny that you mentioned that, actually, because when they did This Is Your Life, John Cena, as hideous as that segment was, when Mick Foley said, B-Squared is returning, and man, have I got some great footage for you. And it was John Cena, as a heel, rapping his way to the ring with B-Squared. I was like, oh my God, you know, we didn't know what we had back then. That was way better than this stuff we have to watch today. Anyway.
One other point on SmackDown was the with Mark Henry, Daniel Bryan main event. I mean, I like Mark Henry a lot, and I think he's done a great job. But watching that match, I mean, it was again a reminder to me of the flaw of continuing to be infatuated with size, and that, you know, Vince continues to push these big guys. When you've got when you're building on guys like Mark Henry and Big Show, it's so difficult to find anyone else that can credibly work with them. And I don't think anyone really bought Daniel Bryan as a threat to Mark Henry. I think they wouldn't be surprised if he won, just because Mark Henry does the slip on the banana peel gimmick all the time. So, you know, anyone can beat anyone if, you know, they're distracted by a random guy coming up on the stage, for example. But as far as credibly having two guys fight each other, it's difficult to find people that are a threat to Mark Henry without going into really big guys, and there just aren't as many talented big guys as there are talented smaller guys. I mean, I think that, you know, if you look in the other combat sport, I wouldn't categorize WWE as a combat sport, but if you look at other, you know, combat sports and fake combat sports, you know, the ones that are doing better on pay-per-view are ones built around smaller people, because you've got more people, so you've got more talented wrestlers, more talented fighters at those sizes, and you've got more charismatic people at those sizes, because there are only so many big guys. So, you know, if you build around guys like Mark Henry, I mean, you have to kind of bring in your Mason Ryans, given there just aren't that many people that can credibly go with a Mark Henry. So, you know, I wish it makes me wish. I mean, it's certainly not a knock on Mark Henry specifically, but that giant mentality still bothers me, in that I think you're really missing out. Whereas if you had a guy like Daniel Bryan, whatever you want to call him, as one of your top guys, I really think that he could make it work. I mean, as a heel, as a top heel, and there's so many guys around his size that he could work with. Whereas Mark Henry, I think he's been doing a great job. But there are only how many feuds does he have in this company? I mean, there are probably eight guys that he can credibly work with.
I like Mark Henry. Yeah. I think it's okay every now and then to have a big giant dude who just goes in there and kills a bunch of little dudes. And I thought Daniel Bryan did a great job with him. It felt like a battle, you know? I like matches every now and then that just feel like a battle. Like, if you watch a Dolph Ziggler-Randy Orton match, it's like a great match. Like a great athletic match. And we see a lot of those on WWE TV, because there are a lot more smaller guys than big guys. So, you know, we get Dolph Ziggler and Randy Orton having a great match. And then you got, Jack Swagger, if he's not facing a complete fool, and he can have a good match. And, you know, you can have these good matches up and down the card with different guys. And, you know, even John Cena, all things considered earlier, you know, with the right guy, is going to go out there and have a good back and forth match. But every now and then, it's fun to just have a guy so big, no one can beat him. But by God, they're going to try. They're going to keep fighting. They're going to get beat up. They're going to get pinned. You know, some people were down on the Daniel Bryan finish, but to me, it was just like, okay, Daniel Bryan went in there with the best guy in the world, who outweighed him by a lot. He put up a hell of a fight. He took a match where nobody cared about the match going in, and they cared about the match at the end. And then he ended up getting hit with a world's strongest slam off the middle rope, which in storyline should kill anyone. And he was beaten by the champ. Granted, the champ had a bad leg, but guess what? He's a champ for a reason. Because he can beat you with a bad leg. Plus, he's going to turn babyface at some point. But whole point was, I thought just a very well put together match. Mark Henry shouldn't be champion for 18 years or 15 years like he's claiming or anything like that. But Mark Henry running roughshod on the SmackDown roster and beating everybody clean. And then the day comes at WrestleMania or whatever where somebody steps up and they have another great match and they beat the guy. I don't know. Every now and then you can do it, and I think it's great right now.
Yeah. I mean, again, I'm not even knocking Mark Henry. I like Mark Henry, but it's sort of emblematic of a continuing trend. And the thing you're talking about in terms of sort of like the guy that just seems like a killer and it's like a real fight as opposed to just sort of, you know, a match. I mean, you can have that dynamic with guys that are much smaller. I mean, the Briscoe brothers have that dynamic down perfectly, and they're very small guys. You know, if you watch UFC, I mean, Anderson Silva has that dynamic. Well, Anderson Silva is actually kind of a bigger guy, but the Cotto Margarito fight this weekend. I mean, their first fight was just a war. I mean, Margarito came across as just. I mean, granted, he was cheating, but yeah, well, in all likelihood. But I mean, he came across as like the cyborg that would just keep coming. With a brutal knockout at the end. So I mean, I think you can very much have that dynamic with guys that aren't so huge. I don't think you necessarily need someone that's 450 pounds. And again, I really am not trying to tear down Mark Henry, but I just, you know, like the Daniel Bryan just sort of beat the point home because I think that Bryan could really be involved in some credible main event programs given his talent. And I think he's even better as a heel than he is as a babyface. But it's. I think you're just sort of limited when you've got guys that are so huge and as your sort of big pushed act.
On that note, Todd, my hardest pushed act. Let's do some plugs. Push your acts, Todd.
Such as it is. Actually, yeah, I've actually got some stuff to plug this week.
Oh my God.
I'm working on a piece for Fighting Spirit magazine in the UK next month on The Rock's return, sort of analyzing it, breaking it down, what's happened, what's coming. I think it's an interesting piece. I'm mostly done with it. At some point, rankings are up on LA Times. It's sort of been a little bit since I submitted them, but hopefully they're going to get posted sometime soon. I've got a piece on Sherdog right now with Jason Mayhem Miller, spoken about the Bisping fight. Sort of an interesting profile I think people will enjoy for the fight coming up this weekend. I'm going to be on Sherdog Radio Network tomorrow. Tomorrow's Friday, yes, tomorrow. Talking all the fights on over the weekend. And then I'm also going to be on Beatdown After the Bell with Jack Encarnacio talking the fights after the show. So after you watch the show, head on over to Sherdog right after the show's over, midnight or so, and I'll be breaking down all the fights. And you can check that out right after the show.
Todd's the man. LATimes.com. He's on the show every week, Freeloaders. If you like what you hear, now's your chance to sign up.
See, I feel like this is a good show, too, Brian, after you buried it in the first 30 seconds.
Everyone needs to understand that I do the Todd shows first thing in the morning, and I had a long Wednesday night. And so I jam myself full of caffeine and then call Todd. And so when the show first starts, I'm like in a haze, you know, hating just every aspect of life. And as the show goes on, I start to pick up a little bit, and then I'm just pouring sweat by the end, which I'm doing right now, half naked. So that's just the way these shows go, everybody. But you can enjoy them every week here on this site, WrestlingObserver.com, so check it out. And thanks, Todd, as always. Thanks, everybody, for listening back. And, very soon, actually, with another Figure Four Daily with Dr. Lucha, Steve Sims, coming up in just a second. So check it out. We'll talk to you again after a while.